Savannah is synonymous with historic preservation. It's why our downtown is such a delightful place to visit for locals and tourists alike. One organization is responsible for starting that historic preservation movement, the Historic Savannah Foundation. The group's leader, Susan Adler, joins today's Commute Podcast to discuss the foundation's recent activity and what she sees ahead for Savannah as the economic rebound takes hold. The Commute is presented by National Office Systems. Welcome to The Commute this Thursday, June the 3rd of 2021. I'm Adam Van Brimmer, opinion editor and columnist at the Savannah Morning News and SavannahNow.com. Our schedule is a little wonky this week with the Memorial Day holiday, so we're giving you an extended version of The Commute today. The Historic Savannah Foundation's Susan Adler is first up. She's been with the organization since early 2020 and is carrying on the legacy established by Anna Colquitt Hunter and six of her friends in the 1950s when they raised $22,500 to save the Davenport House and spark the historic preservation movement. Later on in this episode, Savannah Morning News reporter Katie Nussbaum shares insights on two high-profile stories she's been following, the future of Yamacraw Village and the Confederate Monument in Forsyth Park. First, though, I need to plug The Commute's presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Their name says it all. They are the source for office design and outfitting services in Savannah. We at the Savannah Morning News are proud to call ourselves clients, as are hundreds of other businesses in the Savannah area. National Office Systems has been serving this community for more than 30 years and works with the best suppliers in the business, from Savannah's own Dirt Modular Interiors, which manufactures configurable office environments, to office furniture superpower Herman Miller. Learn more by visiting natoffsys.com. That's NATOFFSYS.com. Now, here's the interview with Susan Adler. Joined on the June the 2nd commute by Susan Adler, who is the president and CEO of the Historic Savannah Foundation, which May was Historic Preservation Month. And it was a very busy month for all of us, and we couldn't get together, but we're together now. And it's probably good timing because we can kind of talk a little bit about what Historic Preservation Month meant, what it means. I think it's really in the spotlight right now with COVID starting to wane. And obviously there's a lot of activity downtown and other historic districts of Savannah. I think most people anticipate a little bit of an economic surge coming. And when that happens, historic preservation kind of becomes always, it's always in the forefront here in Savannah, but it kind of ratchets itself up a little bit. So, Susan, let's go ahead and start. I know that you came on shortly before COVID hit. Can you kind of talk about what Historic Savannah Foundation has done since you came on, and has the mission changed at all?
The mission really hasn't changed. It's always about saving buildings and stories that define our past, present, and future, and that remains the same. I think what we are really working hard on, because it's something that's important to me, is working really well with the community and collaborating and having conversations with people in the community. What I always say to people is we're going to agree to disagree. And we sometimes do disagree with people, but that's okay. But the more important thing is that we have the conversation. We have, through COVID, continued to revolve properties. And again, not necessarily downtown, historic district, but in neighboring districts around downtown. And I'm really proud of that. And we're doing some great work working with community and with people that are investing in those properties to save those buildings.
Yeah. Talk about that revolving fund, kind of refresh our memory on how it works and what you look for.
Okay. So, you know, it's been around a long time. Mm-hmm. And the whole concept is that we will find a building, and Ryan Arbe, who is our director of historic properties and preservation, really scours Savannah to find properties that are abandoned or in need of repair or in need of being saved. Mm-hmm. And our revolving fund, a great committee of community people as well as some board members, looks at the properties and we decide if we're going to purchase that property. And then we purchase it, then we clean it out, get it ready for sale, put it on the market, sell it to, it's an RFP process. So not necessarily the highest bidder will get the property. It's really someone who, what the end use is going to be, what their background in preservation perhaps would be. We really look at the buyer, and then they're awarded the property. We close like a regular closing, and then that money goes back into the pot of revolving funds so we can save another building. And as of now, we've saved over 410 buildings in Savannah.
Yeah, so that's... I think most people are familiar that it goes back to the 50s. It started with the Davenport House downtown at a time when, you know, you look at downtown today and you think, oh, it's must have always been this way. People always value historic preservation and the look of downtown. That wasn't the case. And
it was not the case. Not the case at all.
Yeah.
The Davenport House almost became a parking lot.
That's right. It almost did. I mean, I think I always use the Drayton Tower example. Some people love it and they think it's architecturally great, and other people don't, but I think you'd see a lot more of Drayton Tower than you would the Davenport House had it not been for the historic preservation push in town.
So absolutely.
You mentioned that the focus is in neighborhoods beyond downtown, and we're going to discuss those a little bit, but it referencing what we just talked about, have we reached a point in this town where people beyond historic Savannah have embraced historic preservation and it's kind of got its own momentum and you all can kind of maybe take a step back on that? Are we at that point?
You know, I kind of think we are, but I think, you know, it's the mission's never done, right? I think that the people, I speak to a lot of people, I think people completely understand that it is the historic fabric of our downtown that makes us unique. Mm-hmm. As a city, as a destination for visitors and for people who want to choose to live here. So I think that is definitely a common thread. I think how we preserve buildings, I think could be where people might differ, but I think we're all having the conversation. So I think that's what's important, that we're still talking about it. And we all understand, look, Savannah is just a gem and we do have to preserve it. So I think people agree on that.
The pandemic has wiped a lot of people's memories, but not long before the pandemic hit, a report was filed with Department of Interior that basically said our historic district is endangered. And the reasons behind that largely had to do with interruptions to the Oglethorpe plan, the street grid. How is that kind of process and that discussion? Is it ongoing? And are you seeing some progress toward shifting back to kind of fix some of those wrongs that were pointed out in that report from, I think it was 2019. It's all a blur.
I think it was 18, but yeah, I definitely think there's conversation happening, which I think is the beginning of it. So the answer is yes. I think there's still conversation. I think it's still on people's mind. And I think that I know that there are community people that I'm speaking to about different issues, not just the Oglethorpe plan, but the preservation of Savannah. And I think that's actually what I'm looking forward to with COVID sort of subsiding, continuing those conversations and seeing about initiatives that we can talk about publicly with the community.
Yeah, we definitely have some opportunities like looming right between the Civic Center site and now from what we're hearing about Gamma Craw, which is right there on the edge that maybe that's an opportunity as well. And of course, other things that are going on down around Plant Riverside and that Indian Street District. I think you all are going to be very, very busy in keeping an eye and advocating for down there. But let's move beyond the historic district and talk about some of these other important properties that you're finding in historic neighborhoods that aren't within that National Landmark Historic District. Where are you seeing opportunities? And is that effort any different than maybe what was endeavored taken on all those years ago downtown?
I think the one big difference is timing. I think that, and it's really about, again, I keep going to conversation. It's really about people talking much more now about affordable housing and neighborhoods and the importance of saving neighborhoods and the importance of saving homes for people. So I think it's the conversation that is different, like what we're saying is different, but I think it's the same model. I think there's are buildings that are blighted, abandoned, falling down, distressed. And I think that there's an opportunity to save a lot of those buildings. We have, during COVID, I would say about four of our properties that we revolved during COVID are in the East Side or Kyle Brownville neighborhoods. And I think those are important neighborhoods to save. I think there has to be more conversation about that, But I think that we have people who are preserving buildings in those neighborhoods now because of us. And we have a presence and we're talking to the people in those neighborhoods and things. So I think it's an opportunity.
In talking to some folks at the MPC and others in town, they talk about, you know, if you get a historic district designation for your neighborhood, it does kind of, it brings another layer of oversight. How much of that are you all involved in helping people in those neighborhoods kind of understand that? Or are you not playing a role in that?
So I really feel we need to play a role in that. And I am hoping that that's one of the big initiatives that we start moving into. I also understand that it is the neighborhood that can set those parameters for how they want to preserve their neighborhood. And so I keep saying again, that word conversation, I think it's in conversation. Even here at HSF, there's a few of us that don't agree on how we start that conversation and we're working through our differences. But I do think the most important thing is that we go meet with neighborhoods to inform, to educate, and to help them make the right decisions, because at the end of the day, it is about saving the neighborhood, yeah. Not just the buildings, but the neighborhood.
Right. Right. And I think that just from these other conversations, and of course we had a column in the paper, it's been a couple of months now, but talking about, I think the biggest thing when you have a historic designation is it does kind of limit some of the materials you can use, and it can make it more expensive. But as more and more people realize, okay, it's more expensive here, but here's the benefits there. I think it's really incumbent, I guess, upon you all and neighborhoods to really talk through those and work with the MPC and make sure it's in fitting with the neighborhood and it is in general going to be beneficial to the neighborhood. Is that
right?
Fair way to assess it.
And not make it harder, because what we don't want to do, I think there's two things we don't want to do. We don't want to make it harder for people to save buildings. And then one thing that we see in Savannah, so many of our blighted homes or abandoned homes are because, for example, the family never wrote a will.
Right.
So the family, it's not clear who in the family gets the building, the house, and we can't continue that. So I would argue a great part of what the work that I think HSF should be doing is educating people in neighborhoods, helping to educate people in neighborhoods. And we can't do it alone, but certainly reminding people, write a will, make sure your intent when you're gone for this building is in place, because then we don't displace people. That families will always have a home if it's clear that the home stays with the family. So I think there's opportunities for us to educate and work with people so that they aren't abandoned and that they're not homeless and that they're not, there's always a place. And if there's a family, parents, for example, that bought a home and they want it for the future of their kids and their family. So let's do that. Let's have that conversation.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. It's the number of homes that are stuck in probate for years and even decades is pretty sad. Preservation awards. Every year you do those during Historic Preservation Month. And I know you had 20 or so submissions. You had 8 winners. Can you talk about some of those projects and what people need to know about them in terms of historic preservation efforts around those properties?
First and foremost, I think the most important thing for everyone to know is that there was not a bad project. We had all 20 were phenomenal projects, and we really loved all of them. We do not judge. The board and the staff are not part of the judges. There are community people, 3 community people this year who judged. This year, like last year, because of COVID, we had to do everything virtually. So in years past, our judges would actually go to every property, physically go. This year, the submissions came in, we set up a PowerPoint, and they view everything online. And then the judges through Zoom come together and there are criteria and they judged the properties. But honestly, the judges and even the staff, every property was fabulous. So I hate to just point out to the ones that won, because every one of them was a winner. Would you like me to mention a few? Would that be, I think that might be.
Yeah, are there some that people might instantly recognize? And then we can kind of tell everybody that where they can find information on the others on your website, right?
Yeah, absolutely. The whole presentation, which is about 30 minutes, is on our website. So obviously, Kessler's Plant Riverside was one winner. The Drayton Hotel was another.
At Perry Lane?
Perry Lane, no. The Drayton Hotel on Bay.
Oh, where the Outback Steak. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yep. So it's the Drayton Hotel. Okay. And great project. There was, interestingly enough, a mausoleum that won an award in one of the cemeteries. So it was very interesting. The projects were very diverse this year. What was another one? Now I can't remember because we did the taping so long ago.
And what necessarily do you look for? Just the state it was in to the state it becomes, or?
Community impact. It's more than just the project. Again, all the projects were so good. And the fine line is sort of the community impact or the neighborhood impact of that the building has in the area. And again, community people, three people, judges who were not, they're community people. They're not board, not staff. So.
Okay. Very interesting.
Judging it.
So along with those projects, you have one of your own, Davenport expansion, a little bit of renovation. Can you kind of walk us through where that's at? And as we open back up and people start going back out, that's probably a place they should visit, right?
Absolutely. So let me first say let me talk about the Davenport House a little bit. They closed in March because of COVID, but on June 1st reopened to no incidents. Jamie Cradle, the executive director of Davenport House, is fabulous. She came up with and literally a manual of protocols of how do you reopen and how do you, as a house museum, work during COVID. And I'm really proud to say that that manual, not only local other house museums, but regionally, statewide, the Georgia Trust got a copy of that manual and so did the National Trust. And I believe that we helped inform some people at the very beginning of COVID for how to reopen. And I'm really proud of that. And the Davenport House has had visitors. We're right now back up to pretty much where we were. Yeah, it's really been a boom since about the middle of, towards the end of March, beginning of April. So we are doing pretty well. Our shop is doing well. Mm-hmm. Now, 5 years ago, the institution decided to go on a journey, I'll call it, but it's really it was a big capital campaign. We also own the Kennedy Pharmacy, which is on Broughton Street. And that space has been used over the years for events and meetings and things like that. But it was the plan to move the Davenport House shop into the Kennedy Pharmacy and then to move the staff, which are all their offices are currently in the Davenport House or on the ground floor, to move them into the second floor of the Kennedy Pharmacy. Okay. And then that space in the Davenport House on the ground floor would be available to create an urban enslaved exhibit, telling the story of those slaves who worked for the Davenports specifically. Right. So on December 3rd, was behind the Kennedy Pharmacy before the lane was to build a building that would be event and community space. Because remember, the Kennedy Pharmacy was being used for that. Mm-hmm. And so now that it's the shop, we still needed some event and meeting and exhibit space. So on December 3rd, we broke ground on that new building. The construction has gone incredibly well. Brooks Construction has done a great job, and our architect was Felder Associates, and really the plan is a really great plan. But what is also exciting that we have to point out is that we're going to have a shop on Broughton Street that's been vacant for so many years. So we at Historic Savannah Foundation are restoring a building on Broughton Street. And I'll also add that our part of Broughton Street's really exciting now. Savannah Theater is going to be there. The bike tour company, Savannah Bike Tours, is there. The Honey Bee Store is there. It's really just a fun part of Broughton Street. So Broughton Street sort of gets extended a little bit by virtue of all the work all of us are doing on this side of Broughton Street. So that's just sort of a fun thing. But as I said, the construction's going really well. The new building had many iterations. It is now a one-story building and the design is just lovely. So we are hoping by the end of the year to have all of that work done so that we can then do the work inside Davenport House for the urban enslaved exhibit.
Okay, good. So that is something to look forward to, I guess.
Absolutely.
You know, that's when you're busy, that makes it a little bit harder, but at the same time, it kind of gives you a little bit more sense of purpose to get the rest of this stuff done, right?
And our vision was, you know, when COVID happened, we hadn't broken ground yet. And the building committee led by Gregory Anderson, we all looked at each other and said, you know, now's the time. Let's just do this, because what our vision and our hope was that as the world reopened, we would be reopening. And we thought it would be just sort of a gift to Savannah, and particularly to bring that store back on Broad Street. And we're preserving the Kennedy Pharmacy. I'll tell you a little inside. The floor in the Kennedy Pharmacy is the original floor. And when we started construction, we found that the subfloor was deteriorating, and how to preserve that floor was a big problem. But Brooks Construction figured out how to do it, and we're able to preserve that floor. It's got, the middle is all this tile, and around the edges is wood. So we were able to preserve it, which is really exciting. So when people come into the store, they need to look at the floor.
Look down. That's right. For those that are interested in learning a little bit more about Historic Savannah, and obviously watching that presentation about the Preservation Awards to get more insight on the projects, it is myhsf.org. Susan, thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us today, and keep up the good work.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Thanks again to Susan Adler. We'll shift our focus from the past to the future here in a moment and bring on journalist Katie Nussbaum to talk about Yamacraw and Forsyth. But in the meantime, a small word about a big sale. Right now, you can get 6 months access to SavannahNow.com, the online publication of the Savannah Morning News, for just $6. I'm no mathematician, but that works out to $1 a month. I didn't even have to use my cell phone calculator to figure that out. Our website is the best place to keep up with community news, sports, and opinion makers. Go to SavannahNow.com/subscribe now to get full access. Now to the discussion with Katie Nussbaum. So Katie is in the studio, which is exciting. I don't think we've been back in the studio to do much of anything. I sit in here by myself a lot, which is kind of how things go these days. But it's good to have you back. And one of the reasons you haven't been in the office very much is because you're chasing a lot of stories. And two in particular have come up in the last couple of weeks. One, of course, is the future of Yamacraw Village. The other is the Confederate Monument and what they're going to do with it at Forsyth Park. We're recording this on Wednesday the 2nd. It will go up. Most people will hear it tomorrow the 3rd, which is the same day the Historic Sites and Monuments Commission is going to hear, discuss, make a recommendation on what to do with the Confederate Monument in Forsyth Park. As you talked about in the story the other day, what's at stake here? I mean, these recommendations, at least the initial ones, have been on the table since 2018. What's new tomorrow or today, depending on when you're listening to this?
Right. So this latest recommendation, I think, which was handed down in October, kind of builds on what was recommended before. And so the main recommendation that the group is making now is that they just remove these statues and place them in storage until they can find somewhere to put them. State law prohibits them from being moved to a cemetery or a mausoleum or a museum, which are the obvious choices for relocation at this point. And so the group is just saying, just put them in storage.
And we're just talking about the bus right now of the two generals, not the centerpiece.
Yes.
The centerpiece statues. Obviously, this hasn't come out of left field. Like you said, it was the recommendation was made in October. It's just now kind of gathering steam. The way the process works is the Monuments Commission makes a recommendation, and then it goes to City Council for discussion.
I believe that's correct. I think tomorrow they're just going to be having a discussion. I don't know that they'll be making a formal recommendation on this, but they'll just be looking at this recent report and kind of just, I guess, gathering feedback from, you know, community members and other stakeholders.
Since this kind of came to light a day or so ago, I've heard some feedback of, okay, what does this got to do with the Forsyth Park Master Plan? And the answer to that is nothing, correct? Didn't they tell you that this was not part of what they were doing?
Right. So this was one thing that they are just totally leaving alone because of, you know, state law and everything that's surrounding it. They're going to leave that up to lawmakers, city officials.
Right. In your story, you talked about the fact that there's at least three Georgia areas who have state law or no state law have moved statues, busts, something that was a tribute to the Confederacy. Kind of talk about how they were able to do that, and from your research, are those things gone for good?
So I believe it was Decatur. Where a judge just actually ruled that their Confederate monument, I think he called it a nuisance, and just ordered that it be taken down, and it was taken down. Mm-hmm. They did it in Athens. Mm-hmm. They did that last August, I believe, and that was after their commission voted on a project that was going to, I think, impede around that area and cause some issues.
Yeah, some foot traffic issues.
Right.
I guess they could do that at Forsyth, right?
I suppose. I don't know. So the state laws, it's written, they can be relocated if, you know, you're working on some type of transportation project
right.
that, you know, would, I guess, go through the middle of where they are. And in Athens, that's how they voted to remove them.
Yeah, and I think in Lawrenceville was the other one. I think it was on a courthouse grounds, and it had to do with vandalism, if I remember right. So are you getting any kind of the city council's got a lot of things going on. Are you hearing any kind of scuttle from them about whether they want to even deal with this right now or not?
I don't know. You know, I think the commission was kind of reconvened or started looking at this again under the direction of Mayor Van Johnson. Mm-hmm. So I guess, you know, maybe that's indicative of what they want to do. Mm-hmm. Certainly the last council voted to move them.
Right.
Not many of those members are left on this council.
Right. Yeah, just two, right? Van and Estella Shabazz.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. We've been talking it to death. So I just hope that if we start talking about it again, there's some action to get it closed out. So moving on to Yamacraw, this is something else that came before. This actually came before city council in an informal meeting several weeks ago. Not an informal meeting, I guess their pre-meeting, their workshop. It basically involves the whole idea that Yamacraw has been there for 80 years. It is deteriorated to the point where it would cost them more to renovate than to just knock it down and start over, which of course is generated a lot of discussion because of Yamacraw's proximity to downtown being a front Bay Street. It is a block to the west of Martin Luther King. You could, I think I put in a column, you could hit a 5-iron from City Market to Yamacraw. And of course, Yamacraw was designed in such a way that it's a big piece of property. It has low density. I think it would drive 316 units. I'm going off the top of my head. 315 units. So where is this all going? And since this broke a couple of weeks ago, I know it's generated a lot of discussion. You've heard a lot of things. What's kind of your gut feeling on what's next or what's ahead for Yamacraw and that site?
They haven't actually submitted the application for demolition at this point. They expect to do that later this year, but in my opinion, I would expect that to be approved by HUD and for the demolition to continue. After that, I think it's maybe anybody's guess. What will go there? You know, Housing Authority said they'll do a market study to kind of determine what will be most beneficial. A lot of people that I've spoken with want housing to come back, you know, whether it's affordable or mixed rate housing, market rate housing.
Right.
You know, there's a huge need for that anywhere in the city. So, but it's also zoned for a little bit of everything. Retail, grocery stores, hotels, educational buildings, student dorms. So
yeah,
it's kind of a waiting game.
An incredible, valuable piece of property too. I thought it was interesting. You actually went down and talked to some of the residents and you got kind of a mixed reaction from them about what they wanted to see as well, right?
Right. Several of the people that I talked to had just recently actually moved in and, you know, they didn't want to have to move again. Despite the conditions that they told me about in the units, they said, you know, renovate them.
Right.
Don't kick us out. Don't relocate us. Others said that the conditions were so bad that they, you know, they wanted the place to be torn down and they didn't want to come back there if housing was put back on the site. So
it was
certainly a mixed bag of reactions from them.
Wow. This will be a topic that, like you said, it's probably going to be the fall before they rule on the demolition. If we're going to be talking about this for years to come, I have a feeling.
Yeah, something to watch for sure.
But Katie, thanks so much for what you're doing and for taking the time to talk a little bit about these topics today.
That's all for this episode of The Commute. One more thank you to our presenting sponsor, National Office Systems. Please support them as they support this podcast. If you enjoyed this episode of The Commute and want to hear more, download archived episodes on your podcast app by searching The Commute with that Savannah Opinion. The Commute returns next week when my colleagues Will Peebles and Zach Dennis will handle the hosting duties as I take a brief, way too brief, summer sabbatical. Thank you for listening.